everybody, and welcome to the Nutrition Network. Today we have Melanie, who's ringing all the way from Canada. We're very lucky to have her. She is a natural doctor, is that right? And yeah, that's what I've got here. Or do you call yourself something different?
Yeah, so hi. Thank you for having me on your podcast. My name is Melanie Krishnareki. It's a very long and complicated last name. Most people call me Melanie K. And that's exactly it. I trained as a naturopathic doctor. And I also have a degree in biology, in plant physiology, and botany.
Well, that sounds really, obviously your path has taken you down this, to really look at plants in effective medicine. Did you have that sort of major kind of flash of lightning that this is your path, or did something else strike you, or did you have a good experience with plants?
Yeah. So thanks for asking. When I was studying, I decided to study biology, and while I was studying biology, I kind of was drawn to the plant world. I've always been very intrigued and interested in plants, and specifically the relationship with humans and civilizations. And so one of the topics that interested me a lot was ethnobotany and the study of plants and the cultural implications. And I'm really fascinated with this sort of social aspect that humans have with plants. And then I wanted to further my studies to be able to understand how to utilize them and how to apply them in today's society. I'm extremely fascinated with the historical usages, the traditional usages of plant medicines, and also coming from a kind of science background, I also really enjoy learning about how plants have different pharmacological properties and ways that in Western medicine we've been sort of applying the use of plant medicines. As we know, a lot of medications or maybe a quarter of medications are derived from plants. And so understanding, what is the source of these compounds? How are they created? Is there anything we don't know about plants and how we can use them as humans? What sort of relationship can we develop? So all of these concepts that were my sort of drive to want to study it more. And now I apply it with people, in certain contexts, obviously not all, and, have really delved deep into understanding a little bit about, how we can access plants and how we can use them, in our daily lives.
Well, that sounds completely fascinating because before we went live, we were talking a bit about, because I'm into anthropology, and it just sounds like there's a huge crossover, obviously, in your interest to kind of look at that cultural, the cultural use of some of these plants, which sounds really fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely.
So is it better to, is it better to have a fresh product, or is it fine to, so how could a nutritionist, obviously we're not herbalists, so how do we know how to look for something good, if you like, and do they work, do the kind of like the dried version work as well, or is it, I have no idea. But obviously, I'm familiar with some herbs like ashwagandha and some things that we might use for people with stress or Siberian ginseng or whatever. And we know those kind of work. At least we can see them work. So, yeah, sorry, I'm waffling on a bit, but does that make sense?
Yeah, I think I understand the question. So, there's different views about whether we should be using, a dried plant as a tea versus perhaps a herbal tincture, or just the fresh plant, or whether a plant in a pill has the same efficacy. And there's different practitioners or different people will have different opinions on that. As far as I know, there's not really enough evidence to confirm either way which is better. In terms of the science or what has sort of helped Western medicine to adopt the study of plants, is through this extraction process. So having a plant extract versus the whole plant. And so when we're looking at, the efficacy of plants, the standardized extract or plant extract is what has typically been demonstrated to have some type of benefit. And these standardized or the a plant extract will usually have a higher concentration of an active ingredient or an active constituent. So, medications like, salicylic acid, which is aspirin, is derived from the white willow bark, which is a tree. It's a bark. It's a compound derived, extracted from the bark of the tree. And so, but salicylic acid, tongue twister, is an isolate, which means it's one specific compound that has a very clear mechanism of action to have its anti-inflammatory effects. And now, medicine has, they have created an acetylated form, which makes it more absorbable and bioavailable, but the downside is that it has some of these side effects. And so, if we compare, let's say, a plant extract to a medication is very clear in its pharmacodynamics and its mechanism of action. With a plant extract, there's multiple different compounds in there, sometimes hundreds. For example, valerian root has over 200 medicinal compounds in its form. An extraction process is done in order to pull out the ones that have the most known activity to prove benefit. And so oftentimes, we'll see a product that has what's called a crude plant extract. And this will include higher amounts of the active ingredients, but will also include other ingredients of the plant. And these create something of a synergistic effect or they can offset one another, creating maybe less side effects. But the downside is that this therapeutic efficacy isn't, say, as high as an isolate or a medication. Now, there's benefits, there's pros and cons to both types of ways to use plant compounds. When it comes to a plant, what we're discovering and what science has been sort of demonstrating is that the combination of a mixed active ingredients seems to have greater resolve for more complex chronic ailments, and also possibly for things like multi-drug resistance and possibly antibiotic resistance, but this is still very, very preliminary. And the idea is that, it's that saying, what's toxic or what's high, a medication the saying is that what can be toxic in high doses can be medicines in low doses. And so the plant compound has a lower amount, but can potentially be beneficial in a more long-term effect and in more complex cases. So I'm not sure. I might have totally diverted your question.
No, I think that's completely right. Actually, I was kind of forgetting somehow that, of course, medicines, a lot of Western medicines like aspirin, famously come from plants, but we sometimes forget that, don't we? And of course, some of these medicines can have quite serious side effects. And so, but if you're taking, more kind of like the more complex version, obviously it might, nature's probably put some of the debits and credits and checks and balances within that to kind of make it effective, but also make it safer. So So, yeah, interesting. So if we are looking for something in a product, for example, what's some of the basic things we should look for in a product label?
Sure. So, you know, when we're talking about, you know, natural health products, of course, it includes plants, but it includes, you know, a variety of other things as well. You know, you might find natural health products include vitamins, minerals. They also include probiotics, enzymes. So basically anything you could get over the counter. And, you know, as a naturopathic doctor, for me, the label and what's on it is very crucial to understand how am I going to use this in practice in order to ensure that I could, you know, have some sort of, you know, understanding that what I'm getting is guaranteed to be in there, first of all. And second of all, that I can then track, you know, the progress and see if these things actually have any effects. And so, it's always important to look at the list of ingredients and the amounts and the units on the label. And I'll always say the more information, the better. And if you look at a label and you're like, yeah, what does that mean? Or, you know, how much am I really getting? If that question pops into your head, then I'm not even going to bother with that product because, you know, everything should be disclosed. There shouldn't be any misleading information on a product label. You know, for example, oftentimes we might see something like magnesium 3 and 8, 600 milligrams. And we might say, oh, sure, I'm getting 600 milligrams magnesium. But that's not actually true. In fact, what you would want to see on the label is that it specifies the amount of elemental magnesium because magnesium 3 and 8 is a combined product. It's a combination of magnesium and threonic acid. And so a good company, let's say, will write, you know, 600 milligrams of magnesium 3 and 8, providing 50 milligrams of elemental magnesium. So that's one example. And so you want to ensure that the ingredient list is very specific in giving you the amounts of what you're getting. Often, you know, U.S. in the United States will see things called a proprietary blend, which is a list of different herbal products that you know companies will now trademark. While that could be an effective means for protecting a company, it doesn't help me because I don't know how much of each compound I'm giving to someone. It might not always matter. You know, you don't always need a specific amount of something to have some kind of benefit. But in order to create the best possible plan for your client and then just to track a certain level of consistency, having that information is a very important factor. And also when you're dealing with different populations, different age groups, having those informations are key to avoid any potential, you know, drug interactions, herb drug interactions, or you know, toxicity. And so, you know, I'm always about look what's on the label, find out if you see the amounts and the product description.
So do you think it's laziness or do you think it actually is deceptive? I mean, just, you know, or just a mixture of both sometimes. That people aren't very transparent.
Yeah, I think, you know, in Canada, it's a little different because we here have now what's called the Natural Health Product Directorate. And you know, all natural products now have to have what's called an NPN, a natural product number. And this is a new way to regulate natural products. And this is very recent. It's only been in the last, you know, between five and 8 years that this has started. For a while, it was sort of a free market. The government was not really interested in protecting consumers this way. And then companies were able to do what they wanted. I'm not sure if it was out of deception or maybe they just didn't know. I'm not sure the answer. I mean, I'd like to think it's because they're just not aware of the implications, but, you know, there's, I wouldn't be able to answer. But, you know, there's more interest now.
You know, absolutely. And of course, there's always a mid-balance, isn't there, between protecting the consumer, absolutely, and being able to kind of even through, what do you call it, sort of traditional acceptance of a certain dose, for example, in the products. So talking of dose, does dose really matter? I mean, does it matter?
In terms of the product label or?
Just generally. I mean, obviously, it's interesting, isn't it, that dosage is something that we sort of take as kind of like, what do? We just sort of have it on the back. You just say, oh, take 400 milligrams of magnesium, you know, kind of thing.
Right.
But does it matter?
Yes. Good question. You know, and as an ND, I've often asked myself that question. I'm like, does it really matter? And it matters and it doesn't matter, I would say. You know, like I think there's different products that it matters for. You know, normally when we're taking a vitamin or a mineral, it's because we're trying to restore a deficiency. Either we're not getting it through our diet or we have some kind of, you know, absorption or issue where we're not getting the vitamin or mineral that our body needs. And, you know, there's a recommended dietary allowance that stipulates how much we should get, you know, on a daily basis to prevent the most basic illness. But, you know, more and more, there's a lot of research now into high dose vitamin and mineral as a therapeutic means. And there are upper limits. There's different vitamins that can pose a risk if you're taking too much of something. In terms of plants, absolutely. You know, some plants, can have an extreme toxicity profile. Others can interact with medications. Understanding.
I was going to say, just because I'm curious, but what are the sort of major ones that you should kind of be very wary of? I mean, obviously, arsenic is a plant, you know, which you can't get hold of, but are there ones that you can get hold of that we should be careful of?
Yeah, I mean, you know, St. John's wort, for example, is like the most commonly researched herb for inhibiting the P450 enzyme that is responsible for a lot of drug metabolism, in particular, statin medications. Another big one that often people don't realize is like valerian and other sedating plants can have effects with other sedating medications. And so, having that combined effect can create some possible respiratory issues. There's what else is there? I mean, we know that there's the grapefruit, and recently, you know, Earl Grey tea, bergamot, the compound in Earl Grey, and also the compound in grapefruit. This is the same as St. John's wort. It blocks that CYP P450-3A4 enzyme that is responsible for the breakdown of the statins. And normally, in a short-term situation, it wouldn't cause harm. It's not, you know, dangerous, but it's more in the long term. And some herbs tend to bioaccumulate. If you keep taking them, they'll remain in your circulation longer, and that's when the interaction can occur. But most things have most natural things have a short half-life, which makes them not as dangerous as a medication, for example. But it can happen. And so, you know, speaking to a pharmacist, although, you know, they may or may not know, but there's more and more resources now available for any healthcare practitioner to look up, is there a possible interaction, between different herbs and medications, for instance.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that's a good thing to look at, meaning just make sure that you're following the label, the product label. And, you know, is there any particular type of patient that should be wary of that those toxicities, obviously, people with liver problems or, I guess?
Yeah. So, you know, anyone who's on, you know, there are different classes, well, any medication really, would need to be aware of what possible interactions can occur if they start a medication. Any medication that has a higher risk for side effects or toxicity, I would be even more cautious. So things like definitely warfarin and Coumadin, but also some of the medications for mental illness like antidepressants and lithium. Any herbal combination with these would have to be well researched and to determine the safety. And then anyone who's taking multiple drugs, so more than one medication, people undergoing chemotherapy, people who are taking antibiotics as well. There could be some interactions with antibiotics depending on the herb that you are interested to use.
So we talked a little bit about plant extracts, which you were saying at the beginning. I think you talked a bit about the standardization of those extracts. Do you want to talk about that a little bit in more detail?
Yeah. So, you know, what I like about standardized extract versus a tincture or some other whole plant method of taking in plants is that, you know, each plant is created different based on its genes, the environment, nutritionally. And so the amount of the active ingredients can change from one plant to the next, from, you know, one batch to the next. And so you don't always know what you're getting. What standardization can do is it provides you with an idea as to how much of the active ingredient is guaranteed to be in each capsule. Okay, so normally a standardized extract will be expressed as a percent of an active ingredient. So, you know, you mentioned ashwagandha, it would be a percent withanolides is the active ingredient, and that would be then measured. And when you see that, it means every capsule is guaranteed to contain that amount relative to the other plant compounds. And so these are good from a therapeutic perspective. And so this is why I would think, and I think science is eventually going to get there. With more companies doing the standardized extract, there'll be more research in using these ones from a scientific research perspective, because it's just more consistency in the dose. Now, as I mentioned, you know, because plants have you know, a bunch of different metabolites, and depending on what you're using it for, you know, you might want to do a tincture or a tea versus a standardized extract. Standardized extracts, I find, are really good if you're looking to have an observable difference. For example, you know, increasing white blood cells in somebody who has a low white blood cell count, or decreasing cortisol, or lowering cholesterol. Whereas if you're working with someone with a long-term chronic health problem and you want to have somebody on a plant for a really long period of time, and maybe you're interested in sort of the idea of that cultural relationship, as I mentioned earlier, with plants, you might be more interested in the tincture form, because that guarantee isn't there, and there is some kind of freedom or liberty and just using it more for the relationship that you have with that plant and its compounds, whatever it may be. You know, it's kind of like we use what we can get. But from a Western medicine perspective, from achieving a specific goal, standardized extracts can be my go-to, and I often will look at that on a label, and you know, when I want to achieve a therapeutic benefit. And so oftentimes I like these personally. In my case, if say somebody has, you know, anxiety or the blues, not considered clinical depression or any severe disorder, but are just going through a rough time and want to be able to feel better, then I might want to look at some of the, you know, the anxiolytic herbs that are standardized to contain a certain amount of that active ingredient, just so I know they're going to feel better a little quicker than if we went, you know, possibly with the herbal, which they still might benefit from, but I just sometimes like that guarantee. So it really depends on the, you know, the person in terms of do I pick one versus the other. But from a scientific perspective, that standardization does really help and also is useful.
So you can almost predict the results better, obviously, with standardization.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And also it just ensures that each capsule is the same. And so you're not getting any surprises or any, you know, adverse effects. You kind of know what you're getting. And people, you know, a lot of people like that. They like that consistency. They like to know. And absolutely, you know, when you're dealing with your health, those would be important things to consider. You know, one of the criticisms in science for natural products is that, you know, there's a high degree of heterogeneity, which means that from one study to another, we just don't know, you know, how much of the active ingredient in valerian root was in there. Can we say it was due to that active ingredient or something else? And because Western medicine is very reductionistic in its view of medicine, it creates that, well, we don't know, so therefore it's not good science. And we often will get that. Whereas a standardization, that becomes a little less of an issue, and we can create more replicable studies using things that have a little bit more, a standard, but without having the same isolate that a medication has. And so it's comparable, not the same, but comparable.
So just because we're talking about anxiety and just, you know, we are recording this right in the middle of the beautiful and lovely COVID-19 crisis. What's good for anxiety, just top line?
Yeah, for in herbal? I really enjoy, you know, reading about trying myself these different herbal plant extracts and plants for anxiety. The first one that I find comes to mind is passion flower. You know, the active ingredients have a known effect, have a GABAergic effect, and so they help to increase neuroinhibition. They have a neuroinhibitory effect. Other ones are valerian root. Valerian root can be a little bit more sedating, and often is used as a sleep, but in more panic situations, similarly to passion flower, it's GABAergic and has sort of the same type of mechanism as do those medications for benzodiazepines. And so it can sit on the benzodiazepine receptor similarly to those medications. Another really good one that has received quite a bit of interest in the scientific community is lavender. So lavender, both as an essential oil in aromatherapy and also orally, and especially orally, there's been some good systematic reviews and meta-analyses, which means they've compiled a bunch of smaller studies to find out, you know, does this, do all these studies provide a similar type of result? And they have found it's been a very helpful herbal medicine for relieving anxiety, not better than, but as effective as a similar anti-anxiety medication, but without the side effects. And so, you know, it seems almost too good to be true at times. There's a whole bunch of different plant compounds that we can utilize, and under the right supervision and learning about it and, you know, observing in practice, you know, what happens when people take these things, can be a really nice way of incorporating it into our lifestyle. So, those are some, and then saffron is another one. It's more been studied for, depression.
Saffron.
Saffron. Crocus sativa. Yeah, it's a lot of studies now coming out of Iran for its use in depression. But often, I will incorporate saffron with anxiety type herbs, just because oftentimes it's mixed. You know, people will feel anxious and then they'll feel sadness and it kind of oscillates. And so oftentimes doing both together makes a really nice combination for basic struggles that we're facing.
Fantastic. So what was I going to say? Yeah, so let's move on to talking about some enzymes now. So perhaps you'd just like to tell us a little bit about enzymes, why you might use them, let's just start with that first of all.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, enzymes are great. They they're found in plants as well, in our fruits and vegetables, and they're also found in humans. So they're a big part of our biology, whether we're a plant or an animal. Enzymes are proteins and biological catalysts that basically accelerate chemical reactions. What I like about enzymes is that they have their sweet spot. So too little of an enzyme won't have any effect, and too much of an enzyme won't have an effect. And so, you know, the dose kind of really matters for enzymes. And then the timing and also the conditions, okay? So enzymes are very sensitive to acid. So they do not do well. They will break down in a highly acid environment. And they're also very sensitive to temperature. And so, when you boil, your vegetables, it will denature some of the enzymes that are found in those vegetables, which is why, you know, I'm not sure, you know, I'm not a nutritionist, and maybe you have an opinion on this, why, you know, raw fruits and vegetables, have those added enzymatic benefits versus cooking. But cooking has other benefits, I'm sure. So there's again, pros and cons to both. In any case, enzymes are very sensitive to these things. And so, you know, when we're trying to utilize enzymes from a natural health product or a therapeutic perspective, we have to keep these in mind. Digestive enzymes are kind of the more known usage for enzymes. So people who have malabsorption or who have gastrointestinal disorders or ailments might benefit from enzymes in order to break down their foods a bit better into their macronutrients. I find it, you know, mostly for malabsorption, because you want to ensure that, you know, the macronutrients, your fatty acids, your proteins, and your carbohydrates are broken down to the most basic building block in order for absorption. But what often we don't know about enzymes is that they're also involved in many other factors to our health. For example, in immune regulation, in cell division, and blood clotting, mucus production, and in inflammation. And so, there are enzymes that are really helpful for relieving specifically pain due to inflammation. So, for example, after surgeries, or for any, you know, minor ailment, they may have benefit to reduce pain and to reduce swelling. overall, what enzymes are known to be helpful for are for, again, digestion, for the inflammation, and also just to help improve energy, because it kind of helps, you know, your system function better. But normally, I always recommend to talk to a healthcare provider if you're going to take enzymes, especially, again, if you're on a medication, because enzymes can affect how medications work. So those are sort of some of the reasons why, you know, I might want to, you know, suggest an enzyme product to somebody.
Right. Oh, hold on. I'm doing it the wrong way around. I was trying to mute you and I put you on the other way around. So let us have a wee word about probiotics. So, yeah, I mean, it's a really confusing area, I think, probiotics. I've always been a bit suspicious of probiotics, I mean, to take on a daily basis, unless, of course, there's a need. What's your view? I mean, do you think we should all take probiotics?
Yeah, you know, I think I kind of lean towards your opinion as well. I like probiotics. I don't know if we need them on a daily basis all the time. I like to think that we could, you know, create our microflora just by nature of our diet and our lifestyle. And there's also, you know, what we're kind of born with. You know, I don't know all the details of the research on the microbiome because it's exploded. there's so much research on it now. But I'm sure there is some genetic component to how our microbiome is sustaining itself. With that being said, there are different reasons for that I would potentially recommend a probiotic. Mostly in the short term, but I have seen people's digestive systems improve with a more long term. And by long term, I mean like 6 months, like nothing, you know, 5 to 10 years or anything like that. But a good 6 months of a daily probiotic, the effects were more pronounced, and the person kept ameliorating. And so, you know, as an MD, when we're kind of helping our patients, it's a long-term process, and health is like a building block. You have to go slow, and, you know, put one foundation after the other. You know, it's kind of like academia in that sense, where, you know, you have to start with the little basic information that you know about yourself, essentially, and then slowly, you know, build those different tools that will help you feel better, as best as possible, and achieve some good states of health. In terms of probiotics, you know, the science is big. There's reasons to do it. You know, what's better or worse, or what should we look for is really hard to know. But again, when I go back to that first question about, you know, what do you look for me, it's all about knowing how much of what I'm getting. And so I always want to know how much of each strain of a probiotic is in there. And probiotics their ingredient is what's called a CFU, or a colonizing forming unit. And the minimal amount is 10 to the 9, so 1 billion. And the research suggests that it doesn't seem that, you know, taking a high amounts of probiotics cause any harm. That's sort of my consensus about what I've read. And so you can take a lot of probiotic, and it doesn't seem to cause harm, but whether it causes benefit, I'm not sure. It's kind of like enzymes for me. I'm sure there's a sweet spot where at some point, is it necessary? But, you know, there's different strains that have been researched and are providing a little bit better evidence. But the overall research is kind of inconclusive as to what kind of therapeutic benefit we could expect from a probiotic. You know, we know that the microbiome is associated with many different health concerns, and that our diet plays a huge role. There's a lot of like, oh, you know, human strains are better, dairy strains are bad, plant strains, we don't know. And in my you know, in my perspective, I don't think there's any way to know for sure which is better or not. There just hasn't been enough evidence. You know, they seem to say that human strain, I mean, from a logical point of view, I feel like human strains sure are great because that's what our microbiome is. And so perhaps there's some, you know, logical explanation there. You know, why dairy? Dairy because, that's the best medium by which probiotic cells remain viable. And so having a viable probiotic is what's important, in my opinion. And there's some, you know, potential, theoretical, this again has not been proven, this is just my own theoretical opinion, that the small amounts of dairy in a probiotic can actually help build, you know, immune tolerance to those who are potentially dairy sensitive. And they say that the dairy probiotics can help with lactose intolerance. But again, there's no evidence for that. There's no way of knowing if that's absolutely true. Plant strains, in my opinion, I'm kind of an advocate for just because the majority of us are omnivorous, and some of us are vegetarian, and those plant strains are part of our dietary intake. The idea is that these probiotics are not necessarily to repopulate the intestine, but might help sort of in the digestive process and in the transit. And so probiotics can be used to repopulate, sure, although we don't know that for sure if that's the case, but they could also potentially be considered as a means to help increase and promote a good transit, gastrointestinal transit. But both of these concepts are very preliminary. We also see probiotics now being studied, and speaking of viruses, as having an antiviral effect and can potentially be a benefit in protecting people against viral pathogens. From what I've seen in the science, there has been a potential antiviral effect from taking probiotics at the time of exposure. Whether it has a significant effect and how, if it can decrease or have a better outcome, I think that's still up for debate. But there have been multiple studies that demonstrate that it could help decrease and reduce the intensity of viral illness. And similarly in other immune regulation disorders or autoimmune conditions, there may be some kind of beneficial effect. And so, until there's more evidence, I kind of take the approach of, well, sure, if there's a reason for it, let's do it. You know, is one better than the other? I don't know. I like doing all the human dairy and plant together and having a broad spectrum probiotic because up until now, that seems to be what the research is saying. You know, you don't want just one strain. You kind of want them all to have, you know, the most possible benefit that you can get. There is usually a point where it has its effects and then that's it. Stops, you know, that it ends there. But it can create some benefit. And then lastly, because probiotics, similarly to enzymes, are sensitive to both pH and temperature, I actually personally like, enteric coated probiotics, or probiotics that have the means to withstand the stomach acidity. It's not always necessary because if you take a probiotic with food, eating increases your gastric pH and so can create a less acidic environment, which could then ensure the passage of the probiotics to the intestines. But in certain people that have a delayed gastric emptying or, if you're working on increasing stomach acid, which is something that I actually like doing, then I want to have them take their probiotic on an empty stomach, and these enteric coated actually can help. And so that's something that I personally find an interesting delivery system and a new way to optimize absorption of probiotics and enzymes. So both of these can come in enteric coated capsules.
Well, that sounds, yeah, that sounds like we've got the probiotics covered there. What else was No, it's just like, there we go. So, yeah, so just, we talked about strains, which is great. You know, and I agree with you, as well, which is, I always feel the sort of, you know, what's the word? It's the more balanced things are, the probably the better, rather than going for one absolute strain, because I think it could just throw things out. You know, I mean, that's my very simple way of kind of thinking about that. So that's great. So in total, what are the most important things you should look out for, or practitioners should look out for when selecting a supplement? And we talked a little bit about, you know, the dosage and looking out for that. That breakdown on the label, but is there anything else they should look out for when they're selecting a supplement?
Sure. So if there's any information on the label about product quality and testing, this might be a little bit more in terms of branding and knowing the company that you're purchasing the product from. I like to research the company. So, you know, there's a label and then there's the brand. And for me, I think there's, good reason when a company has been around for a long time. So, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, that they have some reputability, consistency, and has had the time to kind of work and perfect, their quality. The quality control in the natural health product realm is probably one of the more important aspects that I would want to consider. And so knowing that the company is doing testing, you know, before, during, and after production would be an important aspect to me selecting a product. And also how it's manufactured. And so knowing a little bit more about the company's manufacturing process is something that I find really, really important, especially as I'm working with clinicians. But when it comes to the label itself, I just think, you know, again, it comes down to, do I know how much is in there? And also, I forgot to mention, you know, with enzymes, the units. So I mentioned the CFUs for probiotics, but in enzymes, we have something called the USP, which stands for the U.S. Pharmacopeia, or the FCC, which is the Food Chemical Codex. This indicates the amount of enzyme activity. And often we'll see the amount of the enzyme in milligrams, but you also want to know that it specifies this type of activity, because it just guarantees, again, how much enzyme that you'll be getting. And the US Pharmacopeia has a set standard and defined units for each enzyme. And it describes how much of that one unit of an enzyme is able to hydrolyze a nutrient or whatever. And so, you know, having that information on the label is important. Again, CFUs for each of the strains of probiotic is important. Having a standardized extract isn't always necessary, but it could just add value. And then just having all the list of ingredients explicitly written on the label, as well as all the non-medicinal ingredients. So those are also important considerations. And also if there's any cautions or contraindications, the more information, the better, in my opinion.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. We're coming to the sort of top of the hour now, but is there anything you'd like to add in that you don't think we've covered or anything else you'd like to say?
I think that's it. You know, I spoke a little bit about, you know, this idea that plants require, plants have multiple different metabolites, and these can be useful to kind of minimize side effects. But likewise, you know, there's a scientific term that's actually called plant synergy, which means that kind of the sum is greater than each of the individual in each of the individual parts. And so the whole is greater than the sum of each of the individual parts, is what I'm trying to say. And so this idea of holism is true for plants, and it's true for how we can combine different things together. And so science has learned that, for example, piperine, which is a compound in black pepper, can help absorb certain you know, phytochemicals in plants, like, for example, curcumin. And they know how this is done. Valerian and passion flower seem to work better together than either alone. And then the same can be true for certain vitamins and minerals. As a nutritionist, I'm sure you know how, for example, vitamin C can, you know, help iron absorption, as does some B vitamins. And so, you know, this aspect also is an important consideration. You know, a single ingredient can be helpful, but having a formula that has a bunch of different things also is an interesting perspective. And this comes down to, you know, the science and the medical advisory behind a formula. And so in natural health product world, we'll often look to different professionals to be able to come up with the most up-to-date formula that has been demonstrated in the science to have this synergistic effect. And that's something that I also find an interesting aspect of this profession.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And Melanie, thank you very much for your time. By the way, New Roots can be found on under their own website, New Roots Herbal. So if you want to have a look at that, guys. Yes, it just remains for me to say thank you so much, and thank you for talking to us all the way from Canada today. Very
my
excited.
Pleasure.
We hope to have you back, maybe talking about something else. And in the meantime, very good luck with all this, the adventures we have ahead of us. But for now, I wish you the best of health and go well. Thank you very much. Good night.